Dear listener, before we start today's episode, I want to tell you about a resource I've created, which I want to share with you for free. I'll tell you what it is and how to get it. If you're not already writing tests for your Rails code, you're probably aware that testing can help you ship your work faster and with fewer defects. Because testing is such an in-demand skill, but since so few developers know how to do it properly, I've created a resource for you called The Beginner's Guide to Rails Testing. This guide is a short, downloadable book which answers the most common Rails testing questions that beginners tend to have, including, which testing framework should I use, RSpec or Minitest? What level of test coverage should I shoot for? What are the different kinds of Rails tests? What are all the Rails testing tools, and how do I use them? My guide covers these questions and several others. To get the Beginner's Guide to Rails Testing, go to railstestingguide.com. Now on to the episode. Hey, today I'm here again with Nate Berkopek. Nate, welcome to the show.
Hey, Jason. Nice to be here again.
For anybody who doesn't know who you are, do you want to introduce yourself to the listener?
My name's Nate. I maintain the Puma project, and I am a Rails performance guy. I wrote a book called The Complete Guide to Rails Performance. I also have a workshop on Rails performance, and it's what I do, consulting and writing about making Rails apps fast.
Yeah, and recently you graciously let me rip off your book title. You have The Complete Guide to Rails Performance, and now I have The Complete Guide to Rails Testing. It's just a really good name.
I let our mutual friend Ernesto rip it off before you. He wrote like The Complete Guide to Upgrading Rails or something. So I was like, if I let Ernesto do it, I can't let Jason not do it. So I never tried to build a brand around that. It is just a good title.
Yeah. Yeah, it's tough. Like sometimes, like the fashion today with books is like, it's one word and then like some long subtitle, like Grit, The Science of Blah, 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 or something like that. It doesn't work so great with technical books. So you have to like come up with a different one.
I didn't realize that, but that is so true. Like, 2 or 3 word title and then like half a paragraph subtitle. That is so true. There's got to be like a Amazon related reason for that, right? Like having the extra long subtitle is like basically keyword stuffing for book authors.
Yeah. I think the first one I remember seeing is like Blink, Thinking Without Thinking or whatever it is by Malcolm Gladwell. I don't know when that was, but yeah, I don't know why that is, but, anyway, you have your book. I have my book. It's a wonderful thing. So today we're going to talk about servers and that stuff. So I'll tell you, Nate, why I wanted to ask. That's so specific. We're going to talk about servers.
Yeah.
but I'll share like a little backstory, and then I'll get more specific about the topic. So, you know, a podcast is basically a way to get free consulting from people you know, and I consider this an opportunity for me to do that. We had this incident a couple weeks ago where I work. It was terrible. I was sitting in my dining room watching, I think, Jeopardy with my wife on Netflix, and I got a call from my boss, and he said, "Hey, the site is down." And long story short, I spent the next hour and 45 minutes trying to figure out why the site was down and how to fix it. Without getting into the whole story, what I discovered was that the fix was that the database just needed to be resized. It was, I don't know, T2 micro, or I don't even know the AWS database sizes. I only really know the EC2 ones. But I just like bumped it one up because it was like crapping out on connections. It didn't have enough connections available. So once I fixed that, everything was good. It just took like a really long time to figure that out. And then it took an additional painfully long amount of time between the time that I applied that change and the time that it actually took effect. And that kind of raised a bigger question for me, because like in all the like trying to figure out how to get the site back up, I was trying all sorts of stuff. Like, do I need more server instances? Do I need like beefier EC2 instance types and all that stuff? And so my question to you, Nate, which is our topic of this episode, is how do you decide all that stuff?
Well, you know, you just move that dyno slider all the way to the right and just forget about it. You know, never think about it ever again. Just 100 dynos and, you know, problem solved.
Just grab a sledgehammer and drive that nail.
Yeah, so this has been a long sort of standing topic that I talk about a lot. I consider there to be three reasons to work on performance. One of them is to improve the experience for the customer, like make the site feel faster for people that use it. Second reason, which I call scalability, is resource efficiency, really. It's like, how many resources do you need to deploy your app for the load that it receives? And finally, I would call the third reason to be stability, which is just, can your application handle changes in traffic that might cause downtime? Normally, that being sort of like a function of volatility in traffic. So the more volatility, the more stability you need. And I would consider this question like part of the second point, which is, I mean, what I had a little joke there, but like really, if you gave your application that you're running today, you know, if you ran it on the largest possible AWS RDS instance size and like 100 EC2 instances, you could just never think about this problem ever again. But you would run out of money and the company would die first, right? So it's never a question of nowadays with scaling. Like, people talk about scaling in a way that like it's never a question of how do we provision the resources? It's a question of how many. And so talking about this question, what we're really talking about is right sizing, trying to pick the right size database instance, trying to pick the right number of instances to serve traffic. And so that really makes it a cost question. It makes it a resource efficiency question. And this is super common. I can tell you, you know, this is, I'm working at Gusto right now as a contractor, and that's a primary thing that I'm working on there is some cost efficiency issues. And it's a very common thing at a lot of different places that I work. So fundamentally, this then is about two quantities. It's about the amount of traffic that your application currently handles and the amount of traffic that it would handle at 100%. Like, if it was being 100% utilized, this is how much traffic it could handle. And the problems arise when there's a mismatch between these two quantities. So that quantity is just what we might call overall utilization. Because if we take the traffic that we have, divide by the traffic that we could deal with, that would be a percentage, right? So most applications probably should shoot for somewhere between 25 to 50% utilization for a web app. And I say that for a web app because most web apps do have to deal with the possibility that traffic doubles tomorrow. So we can't, although we would like to run utilization as high as we possibly could, maybe somewhere at like 75 to 80%, most web apps just can't do that because traffic is not predictable enough. So you need some excess capacity. So most apps will deal fine with 25 to 50% utilization. So the problem is when you're outside of that range. So most places, will provision too much capacity and have too low of utilization. And the reason why that happens is because it usually people increase their database size or the number of instances or dynos serving traffic to solve an immediate problem, and then they never roll it back, right? So like you double your instance count, or like in that incident that you had, right? You double, triple the size of the database instance, and then you never roll it back. And then I come in a year from now, I'm like, why do you have such a big database, right? So that's the most common scenario, because that fix doesn't actually cause any problems except run out your wallet, right? The other way around, which is too much utilization, is less common but still happens. And I don't see it as much because it's a very loud failure. You'll see response times increase, you know, as utilization approaches 100%, response times increase exponentially to infinity. So once at 100% utilization, response times are infinite. And that's just because you're adding stuff to this queue of work to be done faster than it's being taken off. So eventually response times approach the limit of infinity. And so you'll get outages, you'll get response times going through the roof. That's the kind of problem you had before you fixed the database, right? Like you had too small of a database, it was being overutilized, and then it blew up. So those are the two ways that this can fail. And we're always trying to shoot for the middle, right? So I guess I think about two things. One would be calculating these quantities of utilization, right? Like calculating the traffic that we have, quantifying that, dividing by the quantity of traffic we could handle, and getting that number in front of people. I find usually that part of my job is just calculating this utilization metric the correct way for the first time. And then people see that and they're like, whoa, hold on. Second thing is understanding and monitoring the underlying resources for each part of your infrastructure. So like for a database, having monitors for CPU, connection count, memory use, IO operations, which is a big one on AWS. I recently had to bail out a client that was hitting EC2 instances have read-write throughput limits, which aren't actually shown anywhere. And this particular database was popping up against the total IOPS limit. And they're like, well, we have a bajillion provisioned IOPS. Why doesn't this work? And I was like, well, we need to be on a higher EC2 instance, actually. So there's all kinds of resources for every like underlying part of your infrastructure that you need to know if one of those underlying resources hits 100% utilization, say. So those are two kind of things we've been that you got to pay attention to.
Okay. Well, a piece of good news for me is that I have a lot of room for improvement in that area, because you know what kind of monitoring I have on my infrastructure? Nothing. Actually, nothing is not quite true. Well, it's true now, but I put on a CloudWatch because I had an incident where one of my EC2 instances ran out of disk space, and that was bad. So I put CloudWatch on there, which was super hard and took forever. And then it broke, and now it doesn't work anymore. And so now I don't have any monitoring. And let me ask you this based on that. For somebody who like doesn't have any monitoring at all yet, what should you use? Like, I looked into Honeycomb and, oh crap, oh yeah, Datadog. And I like decided to just take a swing at like installing both those. And it turns out it's not like just a 30-minute thing. It's like a project to get each one of those things installed. And it's like, whoa, I wasn't expecting that level of difficulty. Yeah. So I decided to do that some other time. But I saw a tweet from you saying something about New Relic is maybe a good option for when you're relatively early on. What do you say about monitoring in those early days?
Yeah, so there's kind of a lot of these performance monitoring products, like there's kind of two pieces to the product. So there's like the Ruby integration to the product, and there's the infrastructure part of the product, right? And New Relic has a really good Ruby integration. It was one of the first ones. It's been good. It still is good. And Datadog's, I find, is like a little bit harder for people to grok, like a little bit harder for people to get like meaningful insight out of. On the infrastructure side, though, New Relic's stuff is fine. I just find that New Relic's overall, you have the cool dashboards and stuff, right? But like underneath that, it's just numbers, it's just metrics. So you can take those metrics and combine them and make new dashboards and stuff. New Relic calls that their insights product. In Datadog, it's more kind of just baked in. And I personally have started to really get used to and really like Datadog's approach to that. And I find like creating dashboards and making the metrics that I need on Datadog is a lot easier than it is with New Relic. But as with most things with Datadog, it doesn't really come out of the box with useful insight. Like the metrics are all collected, but they're not really presented in a way that's really useful. New Relic does this really well. Like New Relic's product is probably the best at presenting numbers that are useful and like surfacing the stuff that is useful. But then if you want to get deeper into the details, it's not as good. So like the two vendors I have the most experience with are New Relic and Datadog. And so that's the trade-off that you experience there. Maybe it's personal preference, I think, and like which one of those options you like the best. I will say that I run into a lot of teams with few people that are like working with Datadog, like let's say like 10 engineers or less, and they're like super bogged down in it. Like nobody looks at it. There are no dashboards set up. Like they set it up, you know, 3 months ago and like can't figure it out. Whereas New Relic definitely is always at least used. Datadog seems to be what everybody is switching to, like at over like large organizations. But I think there's still a big trade-off there for small teams.
Okay. So I'm kind of gathering that the way to figure out what level of infrastructure you need for various things is like put monitoring on your infrastructure and then keep an eye on certain things like how's your database connections, how's your disk space, how's your everything. And if you see something that's kind of approaching capacity, that's probably a sign that you need to bump up that particular thing.
So I think what's difficult about that approach is there's not like a clear list of things you should be monitoring anywhere. Like nobody just has a list that's like, if you have an RDS instance, here's the six things that you should monitor. And also like, here's the thresholds that each resource has. Like there's actually nowhere on CloudWatch that I'm aware of. And that'd be really cool if somebody could comment or something that like, if this does exist, because I don't think it does. Like there's actually nowhere to see in CloudWatch, like what the IO limits are for your database. Like there's no like connection to like, oh, okay, here's your read IOPS or total IOPS, but like, here's what you had provisioned for the database. So that's one limit. And then like, here's what the read write throughput is of that instance type, which is another IOPS limit. So like putting together what metrics you should monitor and what the limits for each of those metrics are is actually kind of difficult. So I think that's what makes this really hard is you have to put those things together yourself. And a lot of people end up just like you, which is like, they put together that stuff when it breaks, right? It's like, oh, I found out what the connection limit was when I ran out of connections. Like that's usually the first time that people really figure that stuff out.
Yeah, it's like, okay, I ran out of disk space once, so I know I need to keep an eye on that. Ran out of database connections once, I know I need to keep an eye out on that. Yeah. Okay, completely different topic and completely different question. I'm just curious about what are you up to these days? Because like, I know that at one point in the past, you had like done this course. This was maybe even, wow, this was like early 2020, I think. And you had put out this Rails performance course. But I haven't talked to you a ton since then. What has happened in your life since that time in terms of your Rails performance work?
What has happened? I released a recorded version of my workshop in January, I think that was. It's a kind of interesting approach, I think. At least I think it's interesting. Where there is a lot, it is centered around recorded video, like a lot of programming products nowadays. But it's all delivered via the command line. So there's actually a Ruby gem, RPW, which you can now gem install RPW, and that installs a RPW exe, I guess. You can look at all the lessons in the workshop by just typing RPW list. I did that because all of my products have always contained a lot of hands-on exercises, and I was kind of frustrated that people weren't really doing them. So I decided to deliver the whole product over the command line because now when you like move on to the next lesson, it actually just downloads this kind of pre-baked problem for you and then opens up your text editor to like the README. And it's like you actively have to close the window now to get out of my hands-on exercises and my workshops. So I think that's increased sort of the uptake and what people get out of them. So
oh, that's pretty interesting. I knew you were doing the terminal-based course, but I didn't know the motivation behind it. But that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. Yeah, I've kind of experienced the same thing. Like, so I've taught a certain amount of in-person classes, and that's great because like if anybody is just like sitting there and not doing the stuff, which sometimes people do, and it's like, you fucking asshole, like why are you just sitting here? And like it's kind of disrespectful. But if they're just at home, then there's no like social awkwardness if they're just sitting there and not doing it. And I've heard that like more than 50% of the people who download info products don't even open the thing that they download, or maybe it was even that they don't even download the thing they bought. Whatever the case is, they don't even look at the thing they bought. So the engagement is like really bad. So anything you can do to like get more people to engage is obviously going to help.
Yeah, I don't personally track anything on that front. Like the RPW command line does not phone home with any kind of information at all. So I don't actually know, but that is definitely my sense that a lot of people don't actually get through this stuff. So I basically took the position that the command line is where developers live. They're used to living in their text editor and their command line. So if I can reach the people where they are, man, and deliver the workshop that way.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the challenge of doing the kind of educational stuff that you and I do, is like we don't have x-ray vision, and so we can't tell what people are doing with this stuff or if they're even doing anything with the stuff. That's part of why I can't wait to like when people are vaccinated and the pandemic is sufficiently over to start doing in-person stuff anymore. Because as you and I were talking about pre-show, like there's just nothing like being there in person with somebody and being able to watch over their shoulder and see the stuff they do. And people will ask questions that, again, like we were talking about pre-show, they'll ask questions that they wouldn't bother to like open up an email and send you. But if you're right there anyway, they'll be like, hey, what's that Vim command again or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So I definitely agree. I think I like remote learning for different reasons. Like I think I've learned a lot about like the advantages and disadvantages of both. I think that with remote, like I get to serve a lot more time zones. Like I'm doing a workshop in July, which is going to be like Eastern European time zones. And like, I could never do that in person. I'm not going to go out to, you know, Germany for 4 weeks. But we can do that remotely. And like, I only need like an hour of overlap. So like, we're going to have that. And so that, like, being able to, and also like, nowadays teams are distributed remotely, right? So like, I can't do a workshop for GitHub, for example, because like, no more than like 5% of all of GitHub lives in one city. So, you know, there's definitely advantages and disadvantages to both formats.
Yeah, that's a good point. Funny enough, you said like you're doing a class in Eastern European time and you can't. I actually did once. I flew to Eastern Europe to teach a 3-day class and then back. It's like, you guys can't find anybody in all of Europe or whatever to teach, but no, that's the way it works. And more than once, not specifically Eastern Europe more than once, but intercontinental travel just to teach a class for a few days. It's kind of nuts the way that industry works. But you know, if you have like a super specific topic and a specific timeline, like your pool is pretty limited as far as people who can be there in person and teach that thing.
Yeah, but that's the other thing I don't really like about in-person learning is like, because of that, right, the biggest constraint there is like time, and you know, you being in that country costs money for that company, right? Like you have to stay in a hotel or whatever, they got to pay for your time. So there's this motivation to like cram it into as few days as possible, which I think, especially for what I teach, I find that people need the opportunity to like digest it by working on like applying it to their application, which is something that happens over time. Again, you know, just advantages and disadvantages. I think keeping everybody, like having everybody in the same room and being able to ask, like help each other, you know, is a really important part of the in-person experience. But, you know, I don't think remote learning will go away after this.
Oh, of course not. Yeah. Yeah. There's obvious advantages to it. Speaking of like the material and stuff, the first class that I ever taught that was like an actual formal class, it was a 5-day class. And what they wanted was just, hey, teach us Rails. And me not knowing anything, I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, I'll teach you everything about Rails in 5 days. And it was just so, it's the whole story is a story for a different time, but it was like one of the worst experiences of my professional life because like I just did such a bad job. And then at the end of it, they do these, well, the way all these classes typically work is like, they'll do an evaluation at least at the end of the class. And then typically at the end of each day too, they'll fill out some questionnaire. And at the very end, everybody gave me a 1 to 5 rating. My aggregate rating, and I'll preface this by saying, these are all like on a curve, you know, like there's no Uber driver with like a 2-star rating. Like if you see somebody with like a 4.3, that's like, oh, this guy's terrible. And so I think it was a 2.3 was my rating at the end of that class. Just so bad. The guy put this comment in there. He said, this class was way, capital W-A-Y, this, and underlined, this class was way overpriced for how it went. And I just felt so terrible.
I mean, did he pay? Or did they pay? I guess you don't know.
I guess he was like the one, I mean, obviously he didn't pay it out of his own personal pocket, but he must have been one in charge of the budget or whatever. But just like, so that was a low moment for me. But that was like, and here's the funny thing. This was a class that was supposed to be taught by a different instructor. I was working through what do you call it? There's these companies that do training, companies is what they're called.
Yeah.
They have the relationship with the client and they have relationships with trainers, and they're just like a matchmaker between the trainers and the clients. They had a different trainer in place. That person like bailed at the last minute. And so not only was it my first thing, I had like 3 weeks of notice or something like that. it was like the perfect storm to make it go really badly. Not that that like absolves me or anything like that. But that was great because there was nowhere to go from there but up. And I'm happy to say the next thing I did, that was in like February of 2017. It was just 1 month after that that I went to Bulgaria and taught a three-day Angular class for the same training company. And so I'm like, okay, that first one went so badly. If I ever want to get another training gig with this company again, I have to do really good. And I got the, I worked so hard on getting that curriculum ready. And like each night after class ended, I just went back to the hotel room and spent like, you know, I was up until like 2-3 in the morning preparing the next day's curriculum to make it as good as it could be. And then at the end of the last day, the evaluations all came in, and also they gave me this plastic grocery bag that had a bottle of like Hennessy in it, but it was it was an open bottle. And I'm like, okay, interesting. And they're like, this is Bulgarian, it's some kind of wine, something or other, but it was liquor. It's called rakia, and it was like, it's almost like Everclear. It's so strong. Anyway, they gave me that along with the evaluations. And I got back to my hotel room and I started going through them. And it was like 4.9, 4.8, 4.9, 4.7. And I got through all of them and they're all really good. And I'm just like, fuck yes. I'm like saved. And then I drank way too much of the not there by myself in my hotel room. I think I took like a swig of the rakia and then I went and like celebrated at some bar somewhere. But that was so great to do a good job after having done a bad job on that first one.
I mean, I look back at like the first trainings that I did and I'm just like, how did anybody pay attention to this stuff? Like I didn't know anything, you know, about teaching. It's not like I didn't know the material. It was like, I think you just come in with a lot of preconceptions about like how to teach people stuff and they're all bad, you know, and you get disabused of those sort of notions pretty quickly and figure out what works. So I'm actually not surprised that it only took you one kind of bad session to figure out like, oh, wait a minute. Like I got to do stuff that actually works. Like that's probably is only took me one or two sessions too, but man, my first one or two, it's like, people are saints for sitting through that. Cause I didn't know what the heck I was doing.
Oh yeah. Let me make a guess as to one of the mistakes you made. You tried to teach too much in too small of a time.
Classic. Yeah. I had this notion that like I had like 8 hours. And so it was like, I was going to get through one topic per hour. You know, timing be damned. It was like, I got some slides and I'm going to get through them, you know? So yeah, I think it was a lot of just dumping on people of just too much stuff. And, it's a constant battle for even now to like have to pull that back. You know, but
yeah, it's tough. Cause like, okay, so I'm working on putting together some Rails testing courses and workshops and all that kind of stuff. And it's like, there's kind of 6 or 7 broad topics that I want to cover. There's like, and a lot of them are based around technologies. So like FactoryBot, Capybara, RSpec syntax in general, like what are all these blocks and the DSL and all that stuff. System specs, model specs, mocks and stubs, and then like VCR and WebMock. And it's like, that's a lot of stuff. And even just one of each of those things is a lot. Like, how long does it take you to get good at model testing in Rails? Like, that's a big topic. But at the same time, it's like, what? Now I have like 7 huge courses? I don't know about that. So that's a struggle to like do something where it's like, it's a reasonable size of something to consume. But yeah, the whole thing is just tough. How do you manage all that?
Oh man, I just make the products bigger and bigger and charge more and more. That's the honest answer. I don't know. I mean, I think that's part of why I like the like remote learning approach, because I feel a little bit more comfortable throwing too much at people. because they can just skip it, right? Like, none of my material really like builds on each other. So like most of my like workshops and stuff, like they have like a linear organization, but it, you don't have to go through part A to understand part B. So I'm pretty liberal with my organization of like, well, if you just want to skip to part B, you can do that, you know? So I think I still kind of throw the kitchen sink at people, but encourage them to skip around. And for in-person stuff, it's probably more just like learning to just not have as big of an agenda on the per day basis that I would like.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of in-person stuff, RubyConf, I mentioned this on another podcast episode too, but I saw that RubyConf is happening in November in Denver. Do you think you might go to that in person?
I don't know. I think I might miss it, but we will see. We will see.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that I'm going to go to it. It seems crazy that it's like already happening. It seems very soon. I don't have a problem with it, but it seems really soon.
Well, I felt like in general, so we're recording this in May of 2021. And it felt like there was like a 4-week period here where it was like everybody went from, oh God, it's the coronavirus. I live in my basement. I haven't gotten a haircut in 2 years to like, seriously, the last 4 weeks, it's like, I'm going to go to Tulum. I'm going to go to Las Vegas. And it's just like, the floodgates have unleashed. So it feels weird, but like, you know, I don't know. Things are, I kind of said a while ago, like 9 months ago, I'm like, this is going to like get back to normal in like a faster gradient than people expect. And all of the sort of like caution and pessimism that has like actually served you really well for the last 18 months is very quickly going to be like outmoded. Right. And that definitely feels like it's happened now. So it's weird to be talking about like, wow, it's back to comps now. But like, actually, yeah, like it is back to in-person comps now.
Yeah. And like where I live here in Michigan, you don't have to wear a mask at the grocery store. Like I walked into the grocery store a couple of days ago and they had a sign on the door saying masks not required for fully vaccinated customers. And I actually laughed just out of glee because I'm like, whoa. I don't have to put on my mask. And I went in and, you know, there was still maybe 10 or 20% of the customers were wearing masks. And the thing I find funny is like, if you're not vaccinated, you have to wear a mask. But if you are vaccinated, you don't have to. It's like, oh, so there's these people who are like so rebellious that they're going to choose not to get vaccinated, but also they're going to wear a mask. Like, no, those people don't exist. But yeah, it's felt weird just to like, kind of go back to normal.
Yep. And I mean, I think Rails Conf actually went really well. Like I was kind of shocked, I think, at how well Rails Conf went this year. But it's not a substitute for an in-person conf for sure. So yeah. I'm definitely happy to go back to that.
Yeah, me too. Okay, Nate, last one or two questions for you. Where can people go to find more about what you're up to, and remind us just again, what's on the horizon over the next little bit? If somebody wants to learn more about Rails performance, do you have any stuff coming up that they can get into?
Actually, can we circle back on something that we talked about on a previous podcast for 10 minutes?
Yeah.
I don't know if it was the last one that we did or like the first one, but we talked about like deployment tech and like Docker, Kubernetes, and like we talked a little bit about Convox, I think. I said basically at the time, like, I haven't really tried any of this stuff. I think it's all interesting, but like I haven't had any experience with it. Well, now I have. So I would like to report back as to my experience with new deployment technology.
Yeah, please do.
I recently had a client with the Wikimedia Foundation, which is kind of like an offshoot from Wikipedia. And they have a Rails app that they have deployed. And they had a kind of unique situation where they had deployed previously to like a single node, like a, you know, it was on the Linode. So it's just like a single Linode instance. And they had not outgrown Linode, but like they also have to deploy to an internal cloud. And that cloud only gave them a certain size of node and they'd outgrown it. So the task was like, give me a system that will let me scale this to multiple nodes in these two very different environments of like Linode and then their internal cloud. And so I got to pick up Terraform and also Nomad, Console, and basically the entire Hashi stack, and built them a deployment which will work in both of these different environments. And I'm happy to say it's working. So the Linode deployment is up and seems to be going fine. And we're going to put it on their internal cloud, hopefully this week. And so I got to like do the whole Hashi stack thing, like from ground up. Like the app now deploys into production into a Nomad cluster as Nomad jobs. The databases are all Docker deployed. The app is Docker deployed through HashiCorp Waypoint, which is basically their solution for Dockerizing applications through build packs. So it takes your source code, applies any cloud native build pack to it, and then that turns it into a container image, which is then deployed to wherever you want. To summarize my experience, setting up the Hashi stack was a lot harder than I anticipated, mostly in terms of networking. So getting stuff to talk to each other in a secure way is not easy. basically, it's like a what you would call like a public cloud setup. So like all the IP addresses of this network are like externally accessible. So we have to be careful about the way that the different nodes are talking to each other, because they can't just talk to each other unencrypted, right? Like you could get man in the middle. So like everything, like the database talking to the Rails and so on and so forth, like that all has to be set up encrypted. And I have to say on HashiStack, it was really hard to set up. Like you use like three or four different kinds of like security you have to set up. You have to create your own certificates and distribute them. It's just kind of a pain. I think one thing that did work better than I anticipated was HashiCorp Waypoint. So this is a not insubstantial Rails application I had to deploy. Like several years old, several, you know, 1,000 commits to it. And the process of applying HashiCorp Waypoint, which is, again, basically just like wraps the process of packing the app, deploying it to a production Docker registry, and then deploying it. Like, that worked really well. I don't think we had to modify the app barely at all to get it to work with a cloud native build pack. And basically, you just get to take advantage of the Heroku Ruby build pack, but like deploy it anywhere you want, which is kind of insane because there's a lot of man hours I know that have gone into that build pack. And like you've done a lot of work with Docker, so like you know how hard it can be to like just create like a Docker environment for a Rails app. And like this cloud native build pack stuff like makes it literally turnkey. So was really impressed with that. And so it was kind of hard to get the networking stuff set up. Ultimately, it was really the only way to accomplish this project, because I had this requirement of like, okay, we need to deploy in multiple nodes in two extremely different environments. So like I couldn't just use Amazon EKS or something, right? Like, because that didn't exist in their internal cloud. So like we had to build our own thing from scratch. So I guess I give my HashiCorp stack review like a 7 out of 10. It was still a lot of work and a lot of like DevOps stuff, but I'm pretty happy with the result.
So for anybody who's listening who's not super familiar with Terraform and HashiCorp and all that stuff, I would put Terraform under the category of like an infrastructure as code tool, where it's basically like you want to avoid a situation where you have Snowflake servers where you configure a server manually and then you have the server out there. But what if you want another one that's just like it? You have to like somehow remember all the stuff that you did to make another one. Like, that's bad. And just like you can have Snowflake servers, you can have Snowflake infrastructure. And frankly, that's what I have right now. Even though I don't have Snowflake servers, because I have Ansible, another infrastructure as code tool, orchestration tool, setting that stuff up. My infrastructure as a whole is a Snowflake infrastructure because I like manually configured a load balancer, manually configured the database, all this stuff. And so those tools can make it so you just codify all of the infrastructure specifications. And I don't know exactly how it works because I haven't done it the way that you did it, but you can kind of execute that code that you wrote and it creates the infrastructure for you. Was this kind of your first experience doing the infrastructure as code to that degree, or have you worked with other tools like Ansible or whatever to set up that kind of thing?
To this degree, for sure. It was like my first big experience with it. I mean, I've played around with Terraform before on like personal stuff, but like this is a real app that serves real production traffic. And so there was a lot more to do here. A lot of like weird edge cases and stuff to deal with. One thing that, you know, your listeners might be interested in is this project is the Wiki Education Foundation. I got to get that name right. Wiki Education Foundation. Everything they do is open source. So all of this infrastructure I've described is available on GitHub for anyone to look at. So it's all MIT licensed. You're free to fork it, take it, do whatever you want with it. So I'll give you a link. You can actually see exactly what I've done here. You know, either make fun of my Terraform code or use it on your own projects.
Nice. Yeah, finding guidance for stuff like this is super hard because, like, if you want to find a programming tutorial, then, like, great, there's a million of them out there. But out of every organization, like, they only need to deploy their app to one place pretty much. And so it's like if you have 50 developers, not all 50 of those developers are going to be involved with setting up the infrastructure. Probably just a couple of them are going to be involved with it. So the infrastructure stuff is a much rarer skill than the programming stuff. And then, so naturally you just end up with less written material online about how to do this stuff. I very painfully experienced that when I started evaluating like Ansible, Chef, Terraform, whatever the other orchestration tools are. It's like, wow. When you're setting this stuff up, you're kind of really on your own. There's a lot that you have to figure out just by figuring it out.
And there's a lot of different ways to do stuff. Like, there's a lot of ways to slice these problems and all these tools. And there's not a lot of, there might be like, oh, here's like your getting started 101 level of like introduction to this. But then you're like, wait. There's like 10 different ways I could do this. Like, which one of these is the best way? And there's really not a lot of information out there about that.
Yeah. Yeah. Not only is there not information, but like ask 50 different people, what's the best way to do this? And you'll get
totally.
50 different answers. And you know, you'll probably get the honest answers. Like, there's not really a best way to do it because like, it depends on what you want and all that. Like, you were talking about Docker, like you can involve Docker or you could not involve Docker. There's like pros and cons to all that stuff. I think you can use like Terraform and Ansible together and that like actually makes sense. And it's like, wow, now like just wow. Like there's so many permutations of these different technologies together. And again, like every person is just kind of on their own when it comes to that stuff.
Yeah. 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 It's pretty tough. You know, on the Docker side, I think that part of this has gone extremely well for Wiki Education. Like, They use no Docker in development. So there's nothing is Dockerized. And then it's like Heroku. Like we sort of containerize everything on the way up to production. And I would definitely say that Docker has not been a difficult part of that infrastructure. And I think it brings a lot of benefits, especially for like databases and keeping that stuff up to date, because it's a very simple sort of upgrade process, because like containerizing your database sort of forces you to keep configuration in like a very specific place, because otherwise it just doesn't deploy, it doesn't work. And then upgrading is just a matter of changing what Docker image you have pointed to, right? And I've been pretty impressed with that through this whole process. So definitely containerizing, not going anywhere. I feel like we're definitely like on the innovation curve. Like we have the hype cycle, right? We're in the plane of productivity for containerization, I feel like now. I think that is kind of coming out of the hype dip, and it seems to me like it's maybe a slightly hotter take than I want, but like probably I would not deploy a new infrastructure without containerization in production in 2021.
I don't think that's a controversial position at all. This Docker stuff is like, there's a whole episode. There's not only a whole episode's worth of material. There's like entire podcasts dedicated to this, obviously.
Right.
But my Docker experience is entirely on the development side. So one thing that it took me a really long time to discover is that there's no such thing as Dockerizing an application. You can either Dockerize it for development or Dockerize it for production. And of course you can do both and you can get some overlap there, but I've done it all on the development side so far. I've dipped my toe ever so slightly into the water of doing it in production. And it's like, whoa, this is like 100 times harder than doing it for development. So it's a mix of an encouraging and discouraging, Nate, to hear you that it was easy for you to do the Docker in production part, because part of what has made Docker so frustrating to me is that a lot of people find it easy, but I don't find it easy. I find it super hard. And so it's like, what, am I some kind of idiot or something? maybe yes, but also the documentation on Docker is just, again, it's not really like the official Docker docs. Like, wow. It's like you have to read each sentence like 4 times, and each sentence contains like 3 different terms you've never heard of. And it's like, okay, now I got to go, okay, hang on. What's the difference between Docker and Docker Compose? What's the difference between a container and an image? Like all that stuff. There's just so much stuff to get straight. And the docs like breeze through it all as if you already know that stuff. And so that part can be really tricky.
Also, like Docker is pretty volatile still. Like Docker Compose, like just completely changed the file format for Docker Compose files from V2 to V3. It was like, yeah, all this stuff is gone without replacement. And you know, oh, like we're gonna change this so it only has to work with Docker's form. And it's, you know, you get definitely overwhelmed pretty quick. And it's like all this stuff is changing really quickly. And so that definitely can be overwhelming.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, let's see. I want to ask you one more question, Nate. And that is, if you could remind us again, what is on the horizon for you in terms of what workshops are you going to be offering, if any, in the near future and stuff like that? What products can people go check out and all that stuff?
So my Rails performance workshop remains available to individuals and to companies. So as an individual, if you want to just sign up and take it self-paced, you can go ahead and do that on speedshop.co right now. And you can still book me to teach that and help guide your company go through it as well. So that's all available. I am working on a Sidekick product, I would say. It's called Sidekick in Practice. It will probably be out soon. I don't know. It's like halfway done and needs to be finished up. And it will be a similar format to my Rails performance workshop, where it's going to be delivered on the command line. mostly centered around video with a lot of hands-on exercises. But it's kind of a product where I just kept running into people that had issues with scaling Sidekick in terms of like they just don't know what to do. Like there's kind of a lot of things you have to know or learn about in order to scale Sidekick correctly. And this course was meant to be like a sort of let's write all that down and teach people about that stuff. So that product will be coming out soon, TM.
Okay. Well, great. And I understand that kind of the hub of all your stuff is speedshop.co. So dear listener, if you want to learn more about Nate's stuff, I think speedshop.co is probably the place to go to see all that stuff. Nate, thanks so much for coming on the show.
No problem. Thanks, Jason.